What a great feeling it is. School starting this week and you're not going. What a strange feeling it is. School starting this week and you're not going. That's weird, isn't it? For some, this is the, for all, in a sense, this is the first day of the rest of your life because you don't go to school anymore. But you don't know what's going to happen now. What does the rest of the life look like? When you were going to school, you knew what was going to happen because it was school. But now, what's going to happen? For some people, that's the most exciting news of all. That's the good bit. You don't know what's going to happen. The journey begins. For others, that's the terrifying bit. That's the worrying bit. You don't know what's going to happen. And so I'll just bunker down here and wait for it to happen, but I hope it doesn't, whatever it is going to happen. So let me tell you about the road that's ahead of you and the road that's behind me. You'll see the outline of the talk on pages 3 and 4 of your booklets. A little space for you to be taking some notes there. That's if you still know how to use a pen. Otherwise, you'll take your notes on your phone, provided you don't play games. So, let me tell you about the road ahead and the road behind. Because what's ahead of you is frankly well and truly behind me. So, turn to Psalm 37, which was just read to us. But look at a little later at verses 23. The steps of a man are established by the Lord when he delights in his way. Though he fall, he shall not be cast headlong, for the Lord upholds his hand. I've been young and now am old. Yet I've not seen the righteous forsaken or his children begging for bread. He is ever lending generously, and his children become a blessing. Well, I'm now an old man, so verse 25 has a certain ring to it for me. When I look back down the road, the truth of the psalmist's words there in verse 25 are all too apparent. I've not seen the righteous forsaken or his children begging for bread. And I can testify, verse 26 as well, that he, the righteous, is ever lending generously and his children becoming a blessing. It's not simply that the righteous have enough. More importantly than having enough, they are generous in heart and mind, and their family contribute to the welfare of others. Got a call the other day from a man who's coming up towards retirement, and he rang up to say, well, his investments are coming in. And so he wanted advice from me as to where he can give his money away. He lives in an apartment. He lives a simple life. He's raised his children. They're off now married. He's got his grandchildren. But what he wants to do with his money is give it away. You see, the righteous is ever lending generously. He's a generous man. The life of experience has taught him the generosity of God. I'm not saying there haven't been problems and difficulties. He's had a couple of businesses that have gone bad. But verse 23 and 4 is what I've seen. The steps of a man are established by the Lord when he delights in his way, the Lord delighting in this man's way. Though he fall, he shall not be cast headlong, for the Lord upholds his hand. Sometimes we fall, we have our difficulties, we have our problems, but you're never cast headlong like the wicked because the Lord always upholds his people. So with that middle part of the psalm, let's look back at the beginning that was just read for us so well. At the beginning of the psalm, to find out what the old king, David, was saying. There are two main words that capture it. The first word, and it's a commandment, is fret. Verse 1, don't fret. If you've got a Holman translation, it'll be don't be agitated. But I think most of the other translations leave it as fret. Fret not yourselves because of evildoers. Be not envious of wrongdoers, for they'll soon fade like the grass and wither like the green herb. And again down in verse 7, Be still before the Lord and wait patiently for him. Fret not yourself over the one who prospers in the way, over the man who carries out evil desires. Refrain from anger and forsake wrath. Fret not yourself. It tends only to evil. See, this is the great advice from the old man to the young, written by David, but even more importantly, inspired by God. What you have here is God's advice to you about the life that lies ahead of you. Don't fret. Don't be agitated. Don't be anxious. Don't be worried. Don't be envious. Don't be concerned. Don't burn with rage and anger at others. Don't fret. Don't fret, he says, because, well, what are you likely to fret over? Who are you likely to envy? Well, he says, don't fret over evildoers and wrongdoers. And don't be envious of the wrongdoers who seem to succeed in life, because you'll see in verse 7 they prosper in their ways. Those who are opposed to God may have great success in this world, often do. Sometimes it's because they're opposed to God and they know how to cut the corners and not act honourably and trustworthily and even honestly that they have their success. But don't worry about it. In the long run, they will not succeed. In the long run, they will be found out. Their success will be taken from them. In the long run, they'll not amount to anything. Don't worry about them. King David looks back when he's old and he sees what he's taught me to see, and I've seen it as well. In the long run, the righteous are the ones who are blessed by God. You're given a group project at uni, or you had it at school, didn't you? And one of the little group of four or five of you, or three of you, one of the little group actually doesn't pull their weight, doesn't do the work, doesn't turn up. And rather than the work not happening, you do their work for them, and then they claim credit for the results. Don't fret. Don't get angry. Don't worry about it. In the long run, their laziness and incompetence will be seen by all. They may have a short success on your back, but in the long run, there is no success in that approach to life. Here's a couple of old sayings from an old man. Well, two about money and one about life. Wealth gained quickly doesn't stay long. Always be wary. Bitcoin, be careful. Two, if it sounds too good to be true, it is. And here's about life. If you cheat to win, you'll have only won a bad conscience. Don't fret over other people and the evildoers or the wrongdoers. Don't be envious of them. Don't fret over their success as they prosper in their ways. It really doesn't matter. See, God's first word to us then is, don't fret. The second is, do you see it there? Trust. Don't fret, but trust. You know, don't worry about their success or about them. What you and I must do, what we must do, is keep trusting God and his way of living. Not only because it's the right way to live, but also because it's the successful way to live in the long run. Not in the short run necessarily, but in the long run, it's the successful way to live. For our future is not really in our hands. It's in God's hands. I mean, humanly speaking, you and I, we face an unknown future, don't we? Will your studying at uni or at TAFE be a success or be a failure? Will you be wealthy or will you be impoverished? Will you work to climb up the ladder of career and success here in Sydney or overseas, or will you actually be unemployed for the parts of your life? I mean, will Australia go to war? Will you have to be called up to go to it? Are you going to be single? Are you going to be married? Are you going to be widowed? Will you have children? Or will you not be able to have children? Will you be sick? Will you be healthy? Will you be disabled by illness or by accident? I have seen each and every one of those things in generations of university students that I've been serving in ministry. No one kind of plattered out and said, oh yeah, I am to be disabled. But disabilities come upon many. None have said, oh yes, I'm going to get married and widowed very soon. But it sadly happens. You don't know what your future holds. I don't know what your future holds. We don't know anything about our future except death and taxes. And we have our problems about taxes with some people too. The important thing is not what will happen, but how we handle what happens to us. And if you know that God is in control, then you don't fret about what's going to happen. What's going to happen to you or what's going to happen to others, because you know that your future is safely in His hands and it will turn out for your benefit. So just trust God with the future. Don't fret about it. Just trust God and leave the results to Him. I mean, look again at verses 3 to 6. Trust in the Lord, verse 3. Verse 4, delight yourself in the Lord. Verse 5, commit your way to the Lord. Trust in Him. So the alternative to fretting about the things of life and about the success of the wicked and the rest, the alternative is just trust in God. He's got your best interests at heart. He is concerned for you. He is in control. Trust God. Delight yourself in Him. Commit your ways to Him. God will bring your righteousness and justice in verse 6. He will bring the things that really matter to you and for you. He won't disappoint you, but will protect and provide you to give you the life that really counts at the end. Let me illustrate it for you. I mean, the principle is simple. I trust God. Because I trust God, I choose to do it His way, not my way. It happens in a thousand things. Take the Sabbath. See, God in His loving mercy says, take a day off every week. He gives you a holiday, one in seven. That's pretty generous. There are lots of workers out there, lots of bosses out there who don't want to give you a holiday ever. Whereas God gives you holidays, commands you to have them. But there are some students who will say, I've got to work every day. If I don't work every day, 7 days a week, I won't be able to pass my course. The others will get ahead of me. I won't get the high distinctions. I won't get the first class honours that I really need. But stop and ask yourself for a moment. What is in your best interests? Passing a course that requires you to work 7 days a week will bring you into a profession that will require you to work 8 days a week. Haven't you noticed every year you think you're working hard until you get there next year and then you find out, gee, it was pretty slack back then, wasn't it? You think the HSC was hard? You'll cover most of the curriculum you do in the HSC in the first term at university. Things go harder and harder. When you leave uni, do you think it's going to be easy from there? No. If it took you 7 days a week to do one, it'll take you 8 to do the next. And I don't know whether you know this or not, but there isn't an 8th day in creation. See, it's never good to have a work-life balance of being a workaholic. That's called imbalance. It's never a good situation to be living under such anxiety that you are a victim of other people's demands and requirements of you in the workplace. If you can't pass on 6 days a week, you're doing the wrong course. Change to something easier. There's no shame in it. There's great wisdom in it. You can join the faculty of, but I won't mention that because that will cause people to be embarrassed. Look, it's even better than that. See, did you notice verse 4? Delight yourself in the Lord and he will give you the desires of your heart. He will give you the desires of your heart. God promises to give you the desires of your heart. Well, what do you want? What are the desires of your heart? What do you aspire to? What do you want? What do you desire in life? First class honours? To be a CEO of a publicly listed company by 35? To retire at 45? To travel the world and to see all those places that you can get better photographs on YouTube of? Do you want to go and say, do you want to have a house in Sydney? I mean, there's an incredible desire some people have, isn't it? Or do you want to have a harbour view as well? Do you want the perfect match, the ideal kind of soul person that you can really... Do you want fame? Do you want to make great scientific discovery and win big prizes? And but notice the prerequisite of verse 4, the first half of verse 4. Delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. For when you delight yourself in him, the desires of your heart will be completely different. You won't be self-centered. You won't be materialistic, trying to acquisitively gaining more and more for yourself. You'll want to have things in order to give them to other people, in order to share and benefit others. What are the desires of your heart? What do you want? What do you hope for? What do you long for? What are you planning for? What do you aspire to? Let me show you the folly of the Australian dream. In Jesus' challenging words to the crowds, turn with me across to the New Testament, to Mark's Gospel, chapter 8. Mark chapter 8. It's halfway through. It's a turning point in Mark's Gospel. Very important little section of Mark's Gospel is Mark 8. And look at the challenge of Jesus that he gives to us there in verse 36. Mark 8:36, for what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? Here's Jesus' question for us. What does it profit? What does it profit us to gain everything and lose the one thing that matters? Your very soul, your very life. You then have nothing. Nothing but a coffin and a grave. Nothing but a coffin that's put into a crematorium to go up in smoke. Over the years, I have seen so many sad and mad stories of what people have forfeited their soul for. The girl in the bed, the promotion at the office, the lowering of the golf handicap, the three-bedroom house in suburbia, the boyfriend who didn't serve Jesus, the alcohol, the drugs, the watching of screens endlessly. The list goes on, and they're all so silly. They're all so stupid. They're all so mad. What profit is there in gaining what you want, all the desires of your heart, at the cost of your soul? I know so many sad stories of people losing their soul for no real profit. The bloke who knew the truth of Jesus, but the girl of his dreams had finally said yes, she would go out with him. So he walked away from the gospel because she was a fierce atheist and wouldn't have him if he was a Christian. A month later, she dropped him for another bloke. How do you then go back to Jesus as second best? Jesus is not a default option for you when everything else goes wrong. Or the girl who would sit outside the bar in the bloke's ute as his mates would bring her out beer every half hour or so, as she would wait and wait and wait for him to come out when he felt like it and take her home. She knew the truth of the gospel. I talked to her many times about it. She knew that this bloke was no good. She knew there was no future in him. She hoped to reform him, and yet she hoped, she longed, she loved his affection when he could be bothered with her. And you stand there and you shake your head and you say, what hold has he got over you that you would be this stupid that you would trade your soul for him of all people. But most people, the sale of their soul is not so extreme in its stupidity. For most, the sale price is something more acceptable, something even can be approved of in society. It's just simply the cares and riches of this and the pleasures of life that slowly choke the soul out of a person. See, people don't reject Christianity for intellectual reasons. It's the other distractions of life, the busyness of life, the social swirl of family and friends, the pleasures of youth, the advancement of the career. Nothing comes without cost. There is no free lunch in this world. But people rarely tell you and warn you of the cost. Yes, you could have the promotion. Yes, we've got this wonderful job for you. 1 month in London, next month in Washington. Go back and forth each month like that. And you'll rise up and you'll be important and significant. But they don't remind you that you're going to leave your family. You're going to leave your friends. You're going to leave the roots that give you stability in your life. They're going to leave who you are and why you do. And they don't tell you the cost. They just tell you how great the world is that you are going to gain. But what do you gain if you gain everything and forfeit yourself? All the time, my identity moves slowly and subtly and silently from being a Christian living for Christ to being an engineer or a lawyer or an accountant or a manager or a company director, or as I climb the ladder of success to the very top. And you know what you see when you get to the top, don't you? A lot of other people behind you pushing you down, trying to get in your place. There's nothing to see up there. What you hope and aspire to is revealed in the decisions and choices that you make in life. The choices that you take show what you really want. And the conflict that is within you, the conflict of your values and the conflict of the desires that you have, will all be seen in the choices that you make in the next 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 years. They're resolved in the decisions of life, these conflicts, because ultimately no one can live the divided life. The divided life is unlivable. And the truth will be seen in your actions. Remember, Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, no one can serve two masters, for either he'll hate the one and love the other, or he'll despise the one and be devoted to the other. You cannot serve God and money. But in our hearts, what's there? God, money, God and money. It's not going to work if it's both. So feel the weight of Jesus' challenge. What does it profit a man to gain the whole world? What is it that there is in your life so valuable that you wouldn't give it up? What is the non-negotiable? Whatever else is going to happen, I'm going to do this. What price do you put on your life? Verse 37 drives the point home further with the commercial transaction question of what can a man give in return for his life? And the question is just left hanging. You don't need an answer because the answer's obvious. There's nothing you can give in return for your life. And yet, if you're not willing to die for anything, you don't live for anything either. What will you rather die than give up? Jesus gave this challenge here in Mark 8 when he was explaining to people, the crowds, what you need to do to be one of his disciples. Look back at verse 34. And calling the crowd to him with his disciples, he said to them, if anyone, that means you, anyone, we're all in the anyone category, aren't we? If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross and follow me. For whoever, you're in the whoever category too, aren't you? Whoever it is, whoever will save his life will lose it, but whoever, there we are again, whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. See, Jesus was dealing with the reality of death. His death was just around the corner. He just told them about it. But death is the reality that people spend their lifetime denying and avoiding. You see it in the COVID deaths. The numbers are given to us of how many die, but they're not real people, they're just numbers, aren't they? They don't tell you about these people. They're not people, they're just numbers. Numbers of old people in old people's homes where no one really cares who they are anymore because they don't actually matter. Jesus came to lay down his life for us, to die in our place as our representative, no, even more than that, as our substitute, taking upon himself the punishment that all our sins deserve. And if we're to be his, if we want to follow him, we have to, he says, lose our life for his sake and the gospel's. We have to deny ourselves, that is to say, no to self. To self-will, to self-government, to self-determination, to self-centeredness, to selfishness, and take up the cross and follow him. Christians aren't moral people. Christians are self-confessed sinners. Christians aren't good people. Christians are forgiven sinners. Christians aren't religious people. Christians are Jesus people. For it's by Jesus' death for us that our sins are paid for. It's by his resurrection that new life is given to us. But what is required to be a Jesus person? What Jesus required, not what I, but read it there in the text itself, is to say no to self and yes to Jesus. To lose your life for his sake and the gospel's. That's a big ask, isn't it? You can't actually ask much more from someone than that. Just give me your whole life. That's what Jesus is asking. It really challenges us to answer who we think is the Lord of life. Most people think, and most people live, as if they are the Lord of life, or at least the Lord of their own life. I am the master of my fate and the captain of my soul, as the poet said. Which, of course, is at best complete nonsense. You're not. You should listen to the other poet, John Donne. No man is an island entire in itself. And in the minds of a pandemic around about us, we must listen to what John Donne said about the funeral bell. Don't ask for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. You're not the master of your life. You didn't ask to be born, and you will not be able to avoid dying either. You can't start it, and you won't stop it. You won't be able to stop it and stop its end. You're not in charge. Worse than the nonsense of thinking that you're the Lord of your own life is the antisocial, immoral, self-centered selfishness that flows in modern materialism out of such individualism, that I am in charge of me, that all other things matter if I am authentic to myself, provided I am true to myself. I'm a greedy pig, that's what I am. But Jesus' question to his disciples was, who do you think I am? For in fact, Jesus is the true Lord of life. He's the creator of all life. He's the one who died to bring us life. He's the one who rose from the dead, conquering death for us. He's the one who now rules the heaven and earth as the King of kings and Lord of lords, the judge of the living and of the dead. He is the Lord of life. And he said, if anyone, that's you, wants to follow me, if you want to be my disciple, then you must deny yourself, say no to self. Take up your cross, follow me. Lose your life for my sake and the gospel's. So here we are. The beginning of life's journey. At the new fork in the road anyway. I mean, you did begin some 18 years ago, but now at the major fork in the road, you're officially no longer a child, you're no longer a school child, you're now an adult, you have to pay taxes, you can be called up into the army if there's conscription. You're an adult now and you make your choices. And those choices are going to reveal and answer the question, what truly is in your heart's desire. You won't be able to hide it. You'll just see it in each other. So now here at launch, you've just got a few days before the whole thing gets underway. Well done, you're here. Glad you're here. Here's the opportunity most people don't have. Stop. Think. Pray. Talk about it with others. Hear the arguments and evidences of those ahead of you. Where do you hope to be in the years ahead? What do you want to have or to be or to do in the future? What matters matter to you? What are the non-negotiables in your plans for life? And what are you willing to live and die for? God promised old King David, delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. It's a terrific promise, which he's never failed me in. But it does require you to delight yourself in the Lord, to be committed to him, to trust him. Jesus promised, whoever would save his life will lose it. But he also promised, whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. And that promise was written and sealed in his blood. So the question is not so much what are you going to live for, but who? Who are you going to live for? Are you going to live for yourself or for Jesus? That's really the question. As an adult, I've made thousands and thousands of decisions. But there were two fundamental ones I made in life. One was made in 1969 when I promised a young woman to love her for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and health, until death us do part. That was for me an irreversible decision upon which thousands of other decisions have relied and depended. Because, and these other ones, they're reversible. But that one was a commitment of life to another person, from which come all these other decisions in my life. But the other one was made 10 years earlier in 1959. Yes, I am that old. Yes. When in 1959, I said no to self and took up my cross and followed the Lord Jesus Christ. For the day I gave my life to Jesus was the irreversible decision upon which all other decisions, even the marriage decision, all other decisions have been the outworking and the consequence and have flowed forth. And now I look back and see what old King David said was absolutely true. I've been young and now old, yet I've not seen the righteous forsaken or his children begging for bread. He is ever lending generously and his children become a blessing. And so I challenge you with the words of Psalm 37. Delight yourself in the Lord and he will give you the desires of your heart. Commit your way to the Lord. Trust him. He will act for you. Let's pray.